This edition of the week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco Cell Culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels. Welcome to The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. This week, Lance Liotta and Emmanuel Petrikoin discuss the promise and the challenges in developing clinical proteomics. But first, here's staff writer Cary Grenz with some of the conflicts and controversies reported on The Scientist Daily News.
Ann Harding reports on TheScientist.com that a controversial study showing high rates of cancer deaths among workers at IBM semiconductor plants has finally seen the light of day. In 2004, the computer maker fought study author Richard Clapp over the right to publish his results, which were based on data the company released during a lawsuit brought by two workers. Clapp, who is a professor of environmental health at Boston University, had been hired by the attorneys for the workers to analyze the records of nearly 34,000 employee or retiree deaths between 1969 and 2001. He found higher rates of mortality from brain, breast, kidney, lymphatic, and hematopoietic cancers, as well as melanoma among the workers compared to the general public. When the results were ruled inadmissible, Clapp sought to publish the study in the journal Clinics and Environmental Medicine in a November 2004 special issue on the electronics industry. The Elsevier Journal turned the study down, resulting in complaints from the guest editor. Clapp's study now appears in the October 19 issue of Environmental Health amid some criticism from IBM. IBM spokesperson Chris Andrews told The Scientist that Clapp's findings, quote, aren't credible, nor are they backed by any kind of legitimate science. He added that the corporate mortality file was an incomplete database not intended for rigorous scientific study. Clapp said he's gratified that the findings have been published and might help to protect workers, but added that more independent research needs to be done. Also in The Scientist Daily News, Jui Yajnik reports that Brigham Young University and Pfizer are going to court over the rights to the blockbuster painkiller Celebrex. Brigham Young University and researcher Daniel Simmons filed a lawsuit alleging that Monsanto, a subsidiary of Pfizer, misappropriated Simmons' research on COX-2 to develop Celebrex. The suit, filed Wednesday, October 18th in the U.S. District Court in Salt Lake City, Utah, comes after more than 5 years of discussions, including failed efforts at mediation earlier this year. BYU spokesperson Michael Smart told The Scientist, quote, "We know what we are dealing with and we are prepared to persevere." They are requesting actual and punitive damages and asking that 75 patents be amended to include Simmons among the inventors. Celebrex has earned more than $20 billion for the company, the suit notes. The plaintiffs contend that Monsanto entered a contract with BYU and Simmons in 1991 to partner on the development of painkillers that specifically target COX-2. Simmons and BYU claim that Monsanto subsequently used their research methodologies and data to develop Celebrex outside of the partnership in order to avoid having to share the profits. Pfizer spokesperson Bryant Haskins would not discuss the specifics of the case, but denied the overall allegations. He said, quote, "The facts clearly show that Monsanto met all its obligations with BYU and with Dr. Simmons." He also said, quote, "Dr. Simmons played no role in the discovery of Celebrex, and the allegations raised by BYU and Dr. Simmons are baseless." The full story is available on our website, www.thescientist.com.
Next, senior editor Brendan Marr interviews Lance Liotta and Emmanuel Petrikoin on the merits of clinical proteomics in biomarker discovery programs.
Lance Liotta and Emmanuel Petrikoin made waves in 2002 when they used pattern-matching software coupled with mass spec proteomic techniques to identify idiosyncratic protein signatures in serum from patients with ovarian cancer. The results suggested to some that widespread clinical application of techniques like this were just around the corner. Of course, the reality required a much more careful evaluation of the methods, the signatures, and the reproducibility of the predictions, which came under question in subsequent analyses. Now, as co-directors of the Center for Applied Proteomics and Molecular Medicine at George Mason University, they've continued to investigate the serum proteome, and they continue to be optimistic about the diagnostic potential therein. Thank you for taking some time to talk with us.
Thank you.
So how has your view of the serum proteome and its value for diagnostic purposes changed over the past couple of years?
Certainly has changed considerably. In some ways, we're even more optimistic as to the potential and the richness of the diagnostic signatures that exist as we delve into identifying the vast archive of proteins and peptides in the blood. It's just amazing that these peptides and proteins seem to be coming from every kind of tissue and every cell type. And so that's very hopeful that there is a lot of information that exists in the blood that really could predict what's going on at any point in time in any tissue.
Thank you, Dr. Liotta. Dr. Petrogoyne, could you kind of expand on that?
Sure. I guess, you know, in some ways I would mimic with Lancet. Certainly excitement hasn't diminished at all. And in reality, the information content that we first published on in our Lancet paper is, in fact, proving true. Really, the Lancet paper was about, does information content exist in the low molecular weight region of the proteome? We used a high-throughput, you know, mass spec-based profiling approach to show that the information content existed. In fact, any of the reproducibility questions that came up with that really weren't about the ions that we, in fact, found, but the whole potential for bias that could be creeping into these study sets, which is very important to address. And it's a lesson for everybody to make sure that the study sets that they use for discovery are as well vetted as possible. One of the problems with the early mass spec profiling work was that the mass spec instruments themselves weren't clinical devices. They were inherently, you know, research devices that weren't built or manufactured for clinical diagnostic. So it's not the information content itself that really is brought into question, more of can you actually reproducibly determine these signatures over time, and of course that's what you need when you have a clinical diagnostic.
So this idea of albumin-bound low molecular weight proteins, I mean, when did that kind of start to gel for you guys?
Well, I'll take that. I was actually at an AACR meeting several years ago, probably around 2003, and Lance and I were discussing mathematically the levels of molecules in the blood and how they got there, and, you know, the level of sensitivity of mass spectrometry at that time. We were, you know, in the back of a napkin at a restaurant, putting down different, you know, equations and calculations about how the production rate of different molecules would have to be to retain themselves in the serum. My background in the Food and Drug Administration, we worried a lot about the four cornerstones of pharmacokinetics: absorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion, so-called ADME. One of the biggest problems with concentrations of drugs in the serum are the glomerular filtration that occurs in the kidney. We started, Lance and I, talking about this, and his background as a pathologist, you know, recognized as well that the kidney filtration system is very, very efficient at parsing out different molecular weight information. If you look at almost all the initial publications on mass spec profiling, and now there's hundreds of them, most of them describe molecules that are below 15,000 Daltons. They're very small. So we started thinking about, well, how would you actually see these low molecular weight molecules in the circulation with such efficient kidney filtration? It left you either with the possibilities that the production rate was extraordinarily high, more than we would appreciate, or there's some type of sequestration going on. And it was easier for us to test the latter, that in fact there was sequestration, and we were able to show that in fact if you looked at what was bound versus what was free, almost everything was bound. So we did a series of experiments in 2003 and 2004 that proved to ourselves that almost all the low molecular weight information was in fact bound, and including some of the specific ions that we described in our Lancet publication. We published that paper in Disease Markers at the end of 2003. Lance, you may want to add to that.
So if we look at the peptides and fragments that are bound to other proteins in the blood, such peptides in the past were thrown away. Now if we look at those, we see just thousands of new proteins not known before that could be new biomarkers. So there's a fantastic archive of information. And on top of that, we recognize that most of these proteins were fragments or modified forms of larger proteins.
Yeah.
And the exact size of the fragment or the form of the fragment or where the protein was clipped, at what exact part of the molecule was it altered, that gives a lot of information about the history of what happened to that protein before it got into the blood, which then gives diagnostic information. So that's still another surprise that we found, that not only was everything stuck and clumped and bound, but it was also modified and fragmented, and the specific fragments may have very important diagnostic information. So,
this gets to what you were writing about in our November issue about immunomass spec and how that can sort of parse out in a general way some of what the identities of these proteins are, and then using mass spec to get closer to the identities of where they've been modified, how they've been cleaved, and whatnot. Could you tell us a little bit about how the immunomass spec process works?
Sure, Chip.
Sure. Well, think of immunomass spectrometry like any other standard immunoassay, but instead of having the detector be, say, a fluorescent imager or a chemiluminescent imager on an ELISA plate, that the detector is a mass analyzer provided by the mass spectrometer. So the input to a immunomass spectrometry is an affinity capture system, say using an antibody against the analyte in question, say a fragment-specific anti-peptide antibody that is bound to a microcolumn, whereby serum can be, or plasma, or any body fluid can be passed over that microaffinity column, and because it's set up in an actual flow-through type device, you could end up passing through, large quantities of serum, milliliters if you needed to, and that the analytes would all be seeing all of the bait molecules, say your antibody, all at once, and then after the appropriate incubation and washing, you would directly elute the bound analytes right into a mass spectrometer. The preferred device that we're working with under alliance with PerkinElmer is their orthogonal TOF machine. PerkinElmer's done a fantastic job of basically automating the upfront sample handling and binding reactions in a roboticized platform that it can be immediately read off of a MALDI plate directly in the mass spectrometer. So what you would be doing in this instance is capturing all the different fragment isoforms of a given protein, some of which may be diagnostic and some of which would not. And then the mass spec provides fantastic attributes of size separation, something that really no other machine can reliably do, and in a rapid way, and therefore provides the critical second degree of information, not just the identity of the protein, but its actual fragment size as read out by the mass spectrometer.
So what have kind of the initial results shown? Have there been any kind of big hits so far?
Well, right now what we're doing is it's actually two separate goals, if you will. One is to understand with PerkinElmer the validity of immunomass spectrometry as basically an immunoassay device overall. But the amount of information that we're getting right now from our discovery-based proteomics, which fragments are differentially expressed, is now percolating into an antibody development stage. So we don't know yet how well the immunomass spectrometry platform for diagnostic purposes will work for the specific fragments we're identifying. We're basically getting the antibodies made for some of these.
Still got to develop the baits. Right?
And we're still developing the baits, but then independently we're actually querying and analyzing the machine itself.
And the ultimate goal is a large diagnostic clinical trial that will use that as the readout platform and prospectively test the validity of candidate markers. And so we have a series of milestones to ultimately get this out for
the dream is, you know, public benefit.
Well, yeah, of course, asking you to polish off your crystal ball, I mean, what kind of timelines would we be talking about that might be realistic?
Well, we think 2 to 3 years will be, we'll have some, have finished some validation clinical trials, and we're doing it in a CAP/CLIA environment. That means that we follow College of American Pathologists guidelines as we pursue all the experimental testing, all the clinical studies, and then ultimately we get inspected and see if we can qualify to get CAP certification for this our university lab. The advantage of doing that is that then you don't have to do it all over again to commercialize the test. You save many years. So it's much harder to do things under CAP/CLIA and good laboratory practices. But we feel if we do that ahead of time and in the midst of all our experimental work, then that'll just save time in the end. Because even if you publish a paper that shows very good correlations, you have to repeat the study all over again in a CAP/CLIA lab to be able to offer it as a in under homebrew or under or as a diagnostic submission to the FDA.
So, what kind of indications and what kind of diseases would we be talking about diagnosing early?
We're focusing on major cancers like breast cancer, ovarian cancer, lung cancer, in our agreement with PerkinElmer. But we're also doing discovery efforts in colon cancer and non-cancer diseases such as Alzheimer's disease and bacterial sepsis. So those are that gives you an idea of the different categories of disease we've been looking into.
I mean, I know there are some doubts as to whether early diagnosis and catching things early actually translates to better outcome. Of course, the numbers will look that way because if you can't catch a cancer earlier, the 5-year success rate will obviously be better. But, how specifically do you see this actually translating into better outcomes?
Well, I'll start first, Dr. Petrikoin. We think that there certainly are examples that can illuminate the potential for, early detection, changing kind of the clinical course of disease and outcome. For example, PAP screening and cervical cancer in the Western societies has certainly had a huge impact on that disease. Now we're getting to more HPV-type testing, which can further, refine that. Mammography screening, even with the controversies about whether or not it actually provides overall survival differences, is certainly, from a screening standpoint, change the way breast cancer is managed. But we see, in some ways, especially with some of the proteomic discoveries, maybe too much emphasis on testing the validity of some of these approaches by first looking at an early detection application. Not so much because of the question about whether or not detecting disease earlier truly makes a difference, but because it will take so long to prove whether or not your new method or your new biomarker actually can detect disease earlier. For something like ovarian cancer, it could take 15, 20 years to prove in a clinical trial screening millions of women that you actually can detect ovarian stage 1 ovarian cancer early. And that could take tens and tens of millions of dollars. A noble cost, to be sure, but not the kind of application that you're maybe testing a new method, a new paradigm, or a new biomarker in. So we actually want to see some of the first applications of biomarkers that we are going to be developing in different kinds of clinical applications that can be vetted much more rapidly. These would be things like high-risk screening, or combining the biomarker, a serum-based or blood-based biomarker, with imaging to increase the positive predictive value of a biopsy. Say, a blood-based test for lung cancer detection combined with spiral computerized tomography, which is highly sensitive but very nonspecific, so that we would bring patients under a thoracotomy that would end up in a positive biopsy, not many negative biopsies, or even screening
for patients for relapse and recurrence once they already have the disease. And so these more target-rich environments, I think, are more amenable to some of the initial clinical applications where you wouldn't have to wait 20 years to find out if you were right or wrong, but more like 2 or 3.
Well, I want to thank you for taking some time to talk with us.
Sure. Absolutely. Thank you.
This has been Lance Liotta and Emmanuel Petrikoin talking with us today. And this is Brendan Marr for The Scientist.
Be sure to check out www.thescientist.com for more on Liotta and Petrikoin's work, including a rebuttal from the NIH's Barry Kramer and Jennifer Miller that questions the value of predictive proteomics.
This edition,
you'll also find more daily news updates, web exclusives, and weekly podcast features from the November issue of The Scientist.
Easy to read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.